Hey, denk dran, dass auch dein Immunsystem Hunger hat. Und probier's mal mit den Gesundheitszielen zur Ernährung in der App Auka Navida. Hol dir Tipps, Rezepte und Challenges für dein gesünderes Ich. Jetzt die App Auka Navida downloaden und loslegen. Auka Plus. Aus Liebe zur Gesundheit.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Cat Bailey. With me, as usual, my lovely co-host, Nani Oxford.
Hello, everybody. The sun is out. I stopped believing in the sun and it appeared. What do you know?
More weather conversation. Lovely.
You gotta start with the weather. It's a Canadian thing to do.
No mention of the fact that it's actually an extremely busy week for releases, Nadia?
It's that, too. But you have to understand, like, it's been, like, winter returned for like 2 weeks, and everyone was very pissed off about it. And now it looks like spring might be coming back, and I feel like we should probably sacrifice something to a fertility god before it slips away from us.
Well, I was playing God of War last night. Oh, this game is not an RPG, no. But it has RPG elements.
Yes, I am. I didn't get to bust it out yet because I was finishing up Ni No Kuni 2. So I'll be playing some God of War over the weekend and some Yakuza 6, I hope.
Yeah, you finished Ni No Kuni 2 right before this podcast.
I did, like 15 minutes before.
Now is as good a time as any for a spoilerific wrap-up podcast about its ending, in which we talk about how we just deliver our closing thoughts on the RPG and how we thought about it in general. So we'll be talking about that. It'll tie into my editorial, which you should go read on the site. Ni No Kuni 2 could have been so much better.
Yeah, you.
Which
you got
maybe a spoiler. Yeah, and of course, but this week I've been playing an RPG that came out earlier this month or earlier this year, not this month, and that was Monster Hunter World. I got back into it in a big way, Nadia.
Yeah, I've seen you on your on the PS4 profile. They tattle on you.
Yeah, I know. They're telling you everybody what I'm playing. It's kind of scary, actually.
You can disable that, but I'm too lazy.
Yeah. Well, I disabled the trophies because I don't want people to know what my trophy count is, but because it's kind of embarrassing, actually. But
mine's not good.
Monster Hunter World, I'm finally up to like Hunter rank 29. I'm on this. In order to get to Hunter rank 30, you have to complete a mission where you fight 2 tempered basil juices.
Wow.
And tempered is a stronger, more powerful version of a monster.
Is that the purple version you were talking about last week?
The purple version, okay, yes. Purple tempered.
Monster. Kool-Aid monsters.
And basil juices, I think that's how you pronounce it. It's kind of weird. But they fly around. They're the monster who you'll be fighting a monster, and then all of a sudden a basil juice will show up and start bombing you.
Oh, getting up in your business.
Yeah, like it'll just show up and it's flying overhead and dropping these skin flakes, I guess you could say.
Ew.
That are these pods that explode.
Ew.
Yeah, it's not great. So you have to be really careful about getting up close and personal in its business, because if you do, you'll just have explosions in your face and it's not great.
Wow, natural defenses. Nature's way of saying go away.
Yeah, you got to fight 2 of them.
Oh, boy.
So, of course, there are explosions everywhere.
Uh-huh. How did your PlayStation 4 handle it?
Oh, just fine. I'm playing on a PS4 Pro, I'm not seeing any frame rate drops or anything like that. I finally got, I have a pretty good armor set right now. I finally completed my quest to get the Extermination's Edge, which is the upgraded Nergigante sword. And that involved, and this is such an annoying thing in Monster Hunter World, you have to get these gems, which are kind of rare drops, very rare drops, in fact. And often you'll end up in a bottleneck situation where you have everything you need except for that one item.
Yes.
So you're constantly doing investigations, or you're just fighting them and praying that you somehow manage to get it from either carving it or just as a random drop. And with some monsters, it's like, I have 3 Nergigante gems. And it's like, oh, great. Yay. But with other stuff, it's like, yeah, I need to get at least 2 Rathalos gems, and I haven't seen hide nor hair of those yet, and I'm having a hard time getting investigations for them. So, wonderful. It's going to be... I don't know if I have the energy to keep farming these things, praying that one particular gem ends up dropping.
It's funny, on the flagship podcast, we were talking about how Mike was saying how he can't believe these people who fight these elder dragons and get this rare armor or these rare weapons and just give them to their cat.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my cat has Nergigante stuff because I have so much Nergigante stuff. Like, and also it looks really cute with its little glowing eyes and terrifying claws that rip and tear.
Aww.
But how sweet. Monster Hunter World is... On the one hand, I'm kind of addicted to it,
just
and I want to keep going back to it, especially this past week. I've been playing it pretty much every night in the run-up to God of War. And now I'm just like looking at it, I'm like, I want to play you, but I don't have a reason to.
Yeah, yeah, I know that feeling very much. Once we get into talking about Ni No Kuni 2, I guess we'll talk a little bit about that feeling, which is hitting me pretty hard.
With Monster Hunter World, it's grinding for the sake of grinding.
Right.
It's like, yeah, I'm fighting these monsters because, and I'm going to get this armor because, and I mean, I guess getting better loot is a decent end in of itself. Like, it's fun to experiment with builds. It's fun to try and get the... like, I was going, okay, well, I've got this armor set, but this armor set might be better. Right. And I just have to grind a whole bunch of Rathalos, and then I will have that. And, oh, look, I beat the Devil Joe earlier this week.
Oh, congratulations.
And the Devil Joe is actually a pretty rad monster.
Yeah, I've seen videos of him being pursued. It's pretty cool.
Super apex predator that just, you know, the great whatevers that you fight, the very first monster you fight in the game?
Yes. Great Jagras.
Yeah. The giant iguana.
Yeah.
Devil Joes just eat them.
And that's kind of funny.
Like, they'll be running around and a Devil Joe will just show up and go, "How?" Yeah, I know. And it'll just run around carrying the thing in its mouth.
Wow. Yeah.
It's pretty funny.
That is
pretty
funny.
And Devil Joe is like, if you're just starting Monster Hunter World now, Devil Joe will just show up. Ooh. Which isn't great if you're not at a level that you can actually fight it.
No, but sometimes the thing I like about Monster Hunter World, too, is that if you mind your own business, usually the apex predators won't bother with you. And I say usually, but hang back.
Well, I had a fight the other day, I think yesterday, actually. I was fighting a Rathalos, which is a dragon with a poison tail. And then a Rathian showed up, and that was another dragon with a poison tail. And the Rathian would not leave the friggin' Rathalos alone. They would just fight, fight, and fight. They were chasing each other all over the map. And I'm like, okay, fine, but also go away, Rathian. You're, like, making things kind of harder on me.
Isn't the...
And then in the middle of this fight, and Anjanath, the big T-Rex guy, shows up, too. And so it's like, oh, okay, wow, this is, like, insane.
They had a party.
Yeah, they had a party, but...
But isn't the Rathian, like, a female Rathalos, so maybe they had something else on their mind?
Maybe. I don't know. There's the Azure Rathalos, and then there's the pink Rathian. So.
Right.
Yeah, so maybe they are male and female. I don't know. I don't know my Monster Hunter bestiary.
But that's the interesting part of it, reading up on all the biological, like, you know, nuances of each monster and learning all about them and their anatomy and their habits.
Maybe, yeah.
And beating
there's
them
a new event. A new event just launched, and it's a new siege type thing, and what it is you have this giant fat ass elder dragon with gold armor and a gold tail,
really cool,
going around a cave system, and basically you're trying to hit it with cannons, you're trying to break stuff off of it, and you're trying to track it enough that you can access the next area and then keep chasing it, and then you can actually fight it for a bit. And then if you manage to beat this, then you can get into like the third area, and if you actually manage to kill it, you get, what's really interesting is that you get randomized weapons,
right,
which makes this particular event, I think, Monster Hunter, one of Monster Hunter World's first kind of true repeatables, where you can get randomized stuff, and you can just keep doing this particular quest over and over again. The problem is, I find that quest a little boring.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit boring. I also feel a little bit bad for this dragon who kind of just popped in. It's like, hey guys, and like, wow, did you come to the wrong neighborhood, buddy?
Yeah, it's not even messing with you. You're just like going after it. And it's also confusing on how to actually team up with other players. It's right. Like, yeah, it supports up to 16 players. And I'm like, well, I'm the only one I see in this particular match.
Well, get to work, Cat.
I had no idea how to like summon anybody. I just kind of shot cannons at it, managed to get into the second area, was fighting it for a bit, and then it left. And it was like, great, do it again, and 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 again.
And it keeps coming back, so that's its own fault, I guess.
Yeah, but I don't feel a huge amount of motivation because right. The items that it drops, like I'm looking at the armor, I'm like, well, I got better armor already.
Yeah, exactly.
And the weapons that it can give me, I guess it could give me good randomized swords, but I already got a pretty excellent sword.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're kind of at that point where you're really set.
Yeah, so I'm looking ahead and I'm like, well, I guess I can take on these tempered dragons unto infinity or something, or these until like level 50 where you fight a tempered Kirin, and your ultimate goal is to get like to hunter rank 100, which
wow,
I don't know why I would do that.
Some people do it, but
I mean, if you that's just like how you relax and how you chill, I mean, more power to you. But what I wish they did, I wish they didn't show their whole hand so early.
Right.
If you beat all of the monsters by the credits, you've pretty much seen everything the game really has to offer.
Right.
It's not like Pokemon where you have like secret bosses or secret things to unlock or raid level stuff. Yeah, they're updating with new events and everything, but it's not the same. And so right. I feel like I'm not grinding toward anything. I'm not exactly. trying to accomplish anything. It's just grinding for the sake of grinding, and it's annoying. Like, I really like this game, but I really need to wean myself off it because at this point, it's just pointless.
So are you saying that, like, basically the game kind of, by showing its whole hand, you mean, like, basically once the story stuff was done, that's where people generally say, oh, this is where the game begins. You don't feel the same way?
No, I don't actually, because there is a challenging aspect. It's fun to get high level armor and to try and go for mastery
right.
against these tempered versions of the monsters that you've already fought. And it's also kind of cool to fight, you know, you're not just fighting an Azure Drake or a Pink Rathian. You're fighting a Azure Drake and a Pink Rathian. Oh, and also here comes an Anjanath. You got to kill them all.
Yeah, and they're all pissed off.
Or you have to fight multiples of the same monsters. The problem is I've already fought these monsters.
Yeah, yeah.
Multiple times often.
Yeah.
And it's just like, so one of the final boss battles in Monster Hunter World are like the Elder Dragons, right? Well, they're kind of like the Elite Four Pokemon. You got these three killer Elder Dragons, and then you got the final boss.
Right.
And that's cool. All
yeah.
Right. Yeah. Couldn't we have, like, three more, like, better Elder Dragons to fight once you hit, like, once you hit Hunter Rank 30? Like, something to look forward to.
Right. That's exactly it. Something to look forward to. You really kind of need that.
Yeah. Monster Hunter World doesn't have enough monsters. Like, it has actually a fairly small monster stable.
Right.
Which, on the one hand, that's kind of, I mean, they really put a lot of love and care and just attention to detail in these monsters. But, I don't know, I just feel like I've seen everything I need to see. And this current event doesn't really spark my interest. And I've got a pretty boss armor set at this point. And as much as I don't want to, I just feel like I need to stop. I need to drag myself away.
Time to put it to bed, Cat, until at least some sort of worthwhile DLC comes, because you know they're not going to leave it alone for a while.
I'm really hoping that they announce a really big, fat piece of DLC.
They might at
like
E3.
At E3. Yeah. And they're supporting it with like a multitude of free events, which good on them.
There's some good stuff in it.
You have gotten your money's worth. I've put like 90 hours into this game.
There you go.
I really enjoyed my time with it.
Yeah.
And yeah, the grinding could be a bit much. I was posting a bunch of Simpsons memes during my attempt to get Narragiganti horns, which really only drop in investigations and have a low chance of dropping if you can break the horns.
Right.
And I posted the Millhouse doing, but we already did it.
it took seven hours,
but we did it.
It's done.
It's done.
again and again and again.
And again and again and again and again. All right. Anyway, that's the haps in Monster Hunter World. I'm kind of putting that aside, and I'm picking up Persona 5 again.
Yeah, I noticed you've been playing that a bit.
Yeah, I just really want to get through it.
I want you to get through it. That'd be nice.
Yeah, so that I can actually talk about it. I finally made it into, spoiler alert, Shinjuku.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, so that's, yes. What month is that? June-ish?
That's June.
Yeah.
I saw the gay stuff that people were complaining about.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
As a lesbian, I'm allowed to say the gay stuff.
Yeah. The gay stuff trademark.
Yes, hashtag trademark. But, good old-fashioned gay panic, am I right?
Oh, God. Come on, Atlas, grow up. But I will say there's one gay... Well, she's not really gay. She's more of a cross-dresser, I think. That's Lola.
You mean transgender?
Transgender. I don't know if... Yeah. I don't know how she presents, to be honest.
You mean the lady who's in the bar?
The lady who's
the reporter? Yeah.
Yeah, and she kind of turns it on, so to speak, for, like, her customers, and you could say... But once, like, she's just kind of herself, she's just great. Her name's Lala, I think. I think it's supposed to be a play on Lola, so. But she's great. I really liked her.
I like Persona 5 a lot.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'll say about Persona 5, though, is Persona 4 never felt like it dragged too much to me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the beginning kind of drags a little bit, but I was always super invested in everything that was going on. And it felt like I got a lot more free time. Mm-hmm. To build my social links, mess around in the area, try to find new things in town. And it doesn't feel like Persona 5 gives me space.
Yeah, I will say that. As much as I prefer Persona 5 to 4, I do feel like, yes, it doesn't give you quite as much room to breathe. I think maybe because there's so much more to do. And it's kind of my fault, too, because once I've discovered, holy shit, you can fish, that was the end of that. And I'm catching all these amazing fish, and it's like, meanwhile, my... social link with Makoto is terrible, and I'm like, oh, I never got to sleep with anyone. This sucks.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoy when it turns me loose and I'm just going through Tokyo. I mean, that is a lot of fun. I'm constantly shocked by this sense of deja vu as I look at train stops that I actually, like, passed on a regular basis, and the trains are accurate. Like, the train you take to Shinjuku is accurate to how it is in real life, which... makes sense, because, I mean, it's Tokyo, but still, it's
kind of... Yeah, I went on that train.
Yeah. No, there you go, right? That was kind of weird for you, huh?
It was just for a couple of stops. I mean, a train is a train when you come right down to it, but I kind of made the Square Enix people laugh, because I'm like, they're like, oh, we're taking the train to the Square Enix offices. And I'm like, are we going on a bullet train? They're just like, it wouldn't have time to get up to speed, Nadia, if you took a bullet train.
Did they pat you on the head gently?
Yes, they did.
Say, oh, Nadia.
Yes, they did. I'm very easy to pat on the head.
But I think Persona 5 has a much more involved story than Persona 4.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, Persona 4 is the tragedy of a small town. It's a murder mystery. There's a lot of great individual arcs going on, but it's not trying to do, like, trenchant social commentary to the same level.
No, definitely
not. Persona 5 really has an axe to grind with those in power.
Yeah, it really does. It's like I said on the piece I wrote recently, you can see it on US Gamer, it's a story about kids versus quote-unquote shitty adults.
I mean, yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, to be honest, like, you can criticize it for its take on LGBT folks and its gay panic.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the gay panic is such a minor scene, to be perfectly honest, that I think to blow it out of all proportion is a little silly. Though I'm told they make a comeback.
Yeah.
Goody.
They do, as I recall. But it's not... See, I'm not LGBTQ. I can't really say one way or the other. But they do come back. It's not too bad. But I don't really have the right to say what makes people uncomfortable and what doesn't.
Yeah, well... I mostly rolled my eyes, to be perfectly honest. This is not the first time that Persona's been down this path.
No, absolutely not.
I suppose a little bit of gay panic is better than having an entire character basically have their entire identity be based around gay panic. I'm looking at you, Kanji.
Sometimes I think back to that whole Kanji thing, and I still get mad because it just, yeah, the whole thing was like, oh, I'm so glad I'm not gay, and you didn't have to go down that path, guys. You really didn't.
What's the name of the Wonder Detective from Persona 4?
Yeah, which detective?
The detective that initially you think is a boy, but actually turns out to be a girl and joins the club.
Oh, shoot.
I don't remember her name, but...
It starts with an N, and I'm totally blanking. She's yes, the one you
Naoto.
Dated. How can
yes.
I forget?
Naoto, I think is her
yeah,
name.
Yeah, that's it, Naoto.
Where it's like, the game basically goes, are you transgendered?
Scary.
Maybe you're a trans person. And I was... It really presents it in not a great light.
No,
so.
It really doesn't.
So perhaps Persona 5 is actually a step forward in that regard.
A little bit. Haven't met... how you haven't gotten past the first dungeon yet, have you?
In what, Persona 5?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in the dungeon with the guy. Right? I don't want to spoil too much. But
oh, okay.
I'm in the Shinjuku dungeon now.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm in that
one, basically, right?
God, you're asking me to spoil too much.
Sorry. Okay, I'll say this much. Have you met?
It's the third major dungeon.
Oh, okay. So you've met Yusuke.
Yeah. Yusuke,
the artist.
Which one's Yusuke? Oh, is that the one with the fox mask?
Yeah, that's a fox.
Yeah, him. Yeah, he's in the art museum.
Yeah. Okay. So you have met him then?
Yeah, I like him. He's cool.
Yeah, because I know there was a lot of controversy about him and how he wanted on to basically paint her naked, and after she'd been through the whole episode with the sexual harassment teacher, and not so much what that Yusuke wanted to happen, but the fact that Ryuji was egging her on. So yeah, I see where people are coming from with that too, but I also Yusuke, from what I get of him, he's not interested in anyone sexually. He might even be asexual.
Sure.
But yeah, so there are parts of Persona 5 that kind of made people mad, definitely, and I acknowledge that.
You know, I gotta say, like, the flip side of that is, I think you can criticize Persona 5, but the fact that it even opens itself up to this as a mass market game is actually pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, it depicts LGBT folks. It's actually kind of daring with, like, sexually charged stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a thing you would ever, in a million billion years, see in a Western developed game. You're not going to see this in your average AAA action game.
You're not
going to
see Mara.
Publishers are so risk averse that they're just like, nope, I'm running away. Run away fast. Oh my God.
Let's have a stand-in for this this very complicated topic about racial divides and history. And here, we'll make them elves or something.
No, like Persona 5... It does interesting things, but I didn't mean to get into this big old conversation about this thing. But yeah, maybe I'll make that my summer project.
Please do.
So.
Yes, I think Persona 5 conversations would be a lovely way to pass the summer.
Yes, and also, it's like Persona 5 and Witcher 3, they're like my twin projects. And every so often I get sidetracked with other games, but
yeah.
I'm just determined to finish them someday when I'm not spending 90 hours on Monster Hunter World.
You can do it, Kat.
All right, Nadia, you've officially finished Ni no Kuni 2. You've played all the way through it. Before we keep going, I should say that this is the spoilerific portion of the podcast. If you don't want to hear all of the Ni no Kuni 2 spoilers, I suggest that you maybe put this podcast aside for a rainy day or when you finish Ni no Kuni 2. But okay, let's keep going. Nadia, you finished Ni no Kuni 2. What are your thoughts?
Well, here's the thing about Ni no Kuni 2. Like, I feel very much the same way you do. I'm kind of mad at it because I feel like it could be so much more, and I'm gonna miss playing it. I feel kind of weird about that. I feel almost like I have Stockholm syndrome, because even if I did keep playing it, there's literally nothing for me to do other than keep building my town and doing that. It's like, okay, what's your reward for that, if anything? But here's what I finally nailed down. What kind of irritates me about this game. You have these very serious topics about, like, labor exploitation and tyranny, and every time you get to a kingdom and you see, oh, there's a problem with, like, this person is, you know, destroying their people, they're making them work these terrible hours, and there's strikes and union problems and all this other stuff, and you're like, oh, okay, I can really get into this. And then you find out that a bad guy was controlling the person the whole time, and that's it. And once the bad guy...
Was he controlling them, or was he just kind of there in the background manipulating them? Okay,
it's
so I know
not very
that...
Clear.
with the rat guy, he was definitely controlling the counselor.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Mauser, whatever Mausinger. His name is.
Mausinger. Yeah.
Yeah, you think that it's him being controlled, but in fact it's his counselor.
You're right. And the counselor was saying, well, basically the counselor, you know, fed him lies and stuff like that, and Mausinger listened to the counselor instead of the king, who he was supposedly friends with. And
so I guess the villain takes advantage of the negative emotions or the greed or something.
Or something. Or
with
something
a particular leader, and then is able to control their hearts until as such time they summon their kingmaker or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, I feel like there's two different teams writing this story. And as you say, one team really wanted that happily ever after fairy tale sort of thing going on. And the other team said, we have interesting things to say about this. And this one moment that sums up this game so brilliantly, so perfectly, is right at the end, where Doloran, after he basically says, "Oh no, I did wrong," because of course he did, and he has this serious, poignant conversation with Roland about Roland saying, like, you know, about his talking about his own world getting destroyed, and saying, "I tried to prevent the tide from rolling in, and I couldn't do it. The tide." Sometimes it comes in no matter what you do. And then Evan just pipes up, like, saying, "Oh, you can build another kingdom. It'll be even better than your old one." And, dude, you know, this guy had lost his kingdom that he loved, number one, because Doloran, spoilers, was a king of this realm that got destroyed, because, two, he fell in love with his kingmaker, and apparently you shouldn't do that. And the gods destroyed his realm and blah, 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 blah. So Doloran's basically torn in pieces because his love is gone, his kingdom is gone, he has nothing to really fall back on, and Evan's like, "Oh, just build another kingdom. I did it, you can do it too." It's like, oh, kid, come on.
He wanted to get his magical girlfriend back.
He wanted to get his magical kingmaker
girlfriend.
So
he stole everybody's souls. Yeah. Sounds like a nice guy.
Yeah, and then, like, he says to Roland, "Oh, you're just like me, you want to, like, bring back everything you love," and Roland's probably like, "Dude, it's not like I want to, you know, sleep with a dragon, not like you."
So let's rewind a little bit. Let's talk about Roland. I think Roland is probably one of the most central and most important characters in the game, and yet somehow he gets almost no screen time.
Yeah, he had one super cool moment, and that was you finally get a flashback of, like, him standing in the ruins of, like, this city, and he sees his son, and his son runs over to hug him.
Is that his son or his daughter?
It's his son.
Looks like a daughter to me.
He mentioned several times his son. I never saw him say anything about daughter. I'm sorry. But
looks like a daughter to me.
Bit like androgynous, but
yeah.
So his son runs over and, like, hugs him and then, like, kind of dies in his arms, and, like, Roland, I can't remember what Roland says to him, but the kid's like, "Oh, it's too late for that now." And he pulls back and his eyes are melting. I'm like, "Holy shit, that's incredible." And that was
That's imagery right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. Yeah. I wrote a whole article about this.
Yeah.
Maybe you should go read it on the site. In which, basically, I pointed out that... So the game begins with a mushroom cloud. Like, it begins with a nuclear bomb hitting alternate New York, San Francisco thing. Which is a great first image. It's great. It's really provocative. Great hook. And then Roland shows up in this world, and he kind of looks around and goes, "Oh, that's funny. I'm younger, and... also, the world I was in blew up.
And I'm a hot guy.
Time to roll with it, I guess."
Yeah, and like
and
I
he
said...
And he does.
Well, like I said in the past, it seems like he... At first, he kind of accepts the fact. Maybe he's like, "Oh, I'm dead. This is. I'm just going to roll with this." But eventually, he does kind of get his bearings. And even when he gets his bearings, he doesn't really smarten up and say, "Oh, hey, what the hell?"
Yeah, no, the game never really focuses on him, yeah. And I was sure that I was missing something. I was missing some kind of side quest.
Yeah.
But no, like, mostly his role through the game is to be kind of the, I suppose, the counselor, the guy who dispenses sage advice to Evan. It's like, "I ran my own country, just ignore the fact that it was nuked into oblivion."
I can picture him mumbling that under his breath, and Evan's like, "What did you say?" Oh, nothing.
And all of the focus is on Evan, and you see his conversations with, was it Doloran, the kid with having the tea?
Oh, that, and I knew that. That turned out to be his son from the future.
Oh, right. What the hell? Okay.
Yeah. I do like the image of Dalaran with his stupid Serpentor hood sipping tea. That's pretty great, though.
Yeah, they throw in a lot of weird elements into the story that are kind of like tertiary to the story and also unexplained, like the fact that Roland and Dalaran are connected.
That was okay. Here's the thing, and this is something I was talking about with you on Slack. The first Ni No Kuni, I think most people accept, was very much inspired by The Talisman, which is a book by Stephen King and Peter Straub. And that's a story about a boy who wants to cure his sick mother. So he travels between our world and is called the Territories, but it's basically a fantasy world that's very similar to Ni No Kuni 2's. I haven't played Ni No Kuni, so I don't know how fantasy that world is.
Well, the original Ni No Kuni was about a kid's mom dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like dealing with grief and stuff.
Yeah. So I haven't played the original Ni No Kuni, so like I said, I don't know how close it is to Talisman, but I do know that whole bit with Roland having a twin in the fantasy world was very similar to the Talisman, which states that everyone or most people have a quote-unquote twin.
Why is that important?
I don't know.
Why does that matter?
It's important.
Aside from the fact that it seems as if that was the explanation for why Roland ended up in the Ni No Kuni in the first place?
Yeah, they did not flesh it out. I'm not saying they fleshed it out. I'm just saying like they took this idea from either their first game or just ripped it straight from the Talisman, and which actually does have a reason for having twinners, but I guess they thought it was cool. And
it was such a minor plot point.
It really was.
That I completely forgot about it. I was like, I remembered that Dalaran went and he had committed the grave sin of falling in love with his kingmaker, which had conferred upon him the divine right to rule, which that's weird, but whatever.
Yeah.
And he was punished and he was real sad and he decided to start stealing people's souls in order to bring everything back.
Yeah.
And then I think that it turns out that the king, when he finally gets the kingmaker back, like it turns out that she volunteered to become a monster or something to that effect?
Basically, it's not very well explained, but the way I understand it is she tried to separate herself from her kingmaker powers and mm-hmm. become like kind of a more mortal being, and basically all that sort of kingmaker energy that was in her became the horned one, the monster that you fight.
Oh,
and
okay.
That's what kind of pissed off the gods, apparently.
I see. So that was a thing.
Yeah, that
all
was
right.
Certainly a thing.
The upshot of all of that is that this guy is basically a cautionary tale for Evan. It's like, oh, it could all go wrong, my friend.
Yeah,
doesn't matter if you're a good king. You can make mistakes, and then the gods will come down and rain thunder upon your kingdom and wash it all away, and then you'll be stealing souls just like me.
It's funny, because I didn't even get that impression at all, which is like, okay, that would mean something. That would be an important lesson, but at the end of the game, it's just like I said, Evan's like, oh, just make another kingdom. And then you see he rules over wherever the hell it is, Ding Dong, not Ding Dong Dell, Evermore. And then his son, grown up, rules over Evermore and quote-unquote unites all the kingdoms, because apparently there's still some out there that they didn't get to.
So Dalaran is like, well, he's amassed as a tragic villain and a mirror to Evan, essentially.
Yeah.
And then Roland is also presented as something of a cautionary. It's like, look are the two examples of how things went terribly, terribly wrong.
Right, but we still don't know what happened to make things go terribly wrong in Roland's world, just that there was a war.
Well, you said negotiations failed.
They sure did.
Yeah, the negotiations broke down. I wasn't good enough to get peace. And nuclear apocalypse broke out. I'm real sad about this. But we don't see that from him at all through the entirety of the game. If anything, he seems to be having kind of a blast.
Yeah, he's having a great time. Like,
yeah, he's really enjoying himself. Yeah, he's like, yeah, I'm building a new kingdom. The upshot of my article was basically that I think that a much more interesting story would have been him wondering, like, what's real and what's fake.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is he dead?
Yeah.
Like, mourning his kids, like, feeling regret, and then also feeling, well, if I'm here, I need to redeem myself from destroying my country and build this kingdom together in fellowship with these animals.
Right, with animal people.
Yes, and I think that could have been a really kind of moving story, to be perfectly honest, and And I think it would have been a great reflection on like today's politics, and it would have made, I think, the optimism of Ni No Kuni 2 mm-hmm. ring a lot truer, I think.
Absolutely.
And look, I'm not a writer. I'm just saying that it strikes me as a missed opportunity, and I think it would have been much more in line with the legacy of Ghibli.
No, I totally agree, and I noticed you made that comparison in your article to The Wind Also Rises. Hmm. And yeah, I feel like that's the thing that makes me so angry about Ni No Kuni 2. It's not a terrible game that I can just write off and say, oh, whatever, that was trash. With a few adjustments, like just to the characters, to the storytelling, it could have been a really fantastic game. But when you put such an emphasis on the story and shove it in your face and it's so bland, I'm going to get kind of mad about that. It's not like, say, playing Etrian Odyssey 5, where the story's totally in the background. It's something, it's just there for you to, like, you know, kind of get a laugh out of once in a while. The main focus is the gameplay. Ni No Kuni 2 isn't like that. Ni No Kuni 2 wants you to sit there and pay attention and listen to what these people are saying, and they're not saying anything worth really listening to, unfortunately.
Well, Ni No Kuni 2's systems aren't actually that interesting. I think the castle building is definitely the best part of it.
Yeah, I even got bored of that after a while.
Admittedly, it was a bit of a grind because you're basically doing what my partner would call a tap game.
Yes, it
where
was.
You're just going back periodically and saying, oh, built up some more coins, tap, yay, tap, tap. and then steadily building up your castle. And it really annoyed the hell out of me that they gated the progress behind your castle being a certain level.
Yeah.
I thought that was actually a fairly major misstep. And then also making all of the quests fetch quests. The secondary quests would have been such a great opportunity to get to know the rest of the cast, who just basically do nothing through the entirety of the story, Roland included.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head earlier when you said you go through Ni No Kuni 2 feeling like you missed a subquest somewhere, and there is no subquest; it is not there.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's not like there's nothing to do. I mean, lots of side quests.
Oh, God, yeah. But they're all like, you know, oh, beat this monster, which is fine. I liked kind of beating up the tainted monsters. I liked the battle system well enough. But there's just...
I liked it okay by the end.
Yeah.
What was your party?
I usually used a Roland as my first character, and then Bracken, and then Leander, although... For the end game, I switched Bracken for Evan because he had to use that stupid sword that was didn't do much. So,
yeah, Evan was self-evidently one of the strongest characters. So I went with Evan, Roland, and pink-haired engineer lady.
That's Bracken.
Bracken? Okay. And I controlled her for the most part. And what you could do is you could set up a healing force field.
Right.
That would basically just give area of effect healing as long as you stood in that particular circle. And if you put it in front of a boss, it would heal you faster than they could actually really damage you. And so I could wail away at even pretty strong enemies. And then once I set up the healing force field, I would often switch over to Evan and just start going to town with particularly powerful spells or something to that effect.
Yeah, he has some good ones, but I found I was most comfortable with Roland's swordplay, so I just used that. And he had some really powerful skills that once he upgraded them.
Roland is one of the best characters as well. Very, very easy to use. That's why I ended up going with the party that I did. It goes to show that how interesting the cast members were that I can barely remember their names. But. And then again, I couldn't remember who Naoto was from Persona 4, and she was one of my favorite characters, so there you go, right?
Well, how long ago did you play Persona 4 versus how long ago did you play Ni No Kuni 2?
That is true. I played Persona 4 Golden, I finished it 5 years ago, versus Ni No Kuni 2, which I finished last month.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's what I'm wondering. Ni No Kuni 2 reviewed pretty well, and... I feel like I'm in the minority of people who are like, because a lot of people are praising it and saying that they really like it. And what am I missing?
I don't know, because I'm kind of in the same field. And to be totally honest with you, I think more people feel the same way as we do than you think. Like, I was looking around on game FAQs and stuff like that, and people talking about what the game is lacking versus Ni No Kuni 1. I told you about the woman I buy my cat food from. If she happens to be listening to this, hi, how you doing? I walked in the other day and she's like, okay, Ni No Kuni 2, what do you think? And I'm like, basically relayed a lot of the stuff we've been talking about here. And she's like, that's what I've been saying. Everyone says I'm crazy. She says she's like reading a review saying, what are these people getting that I'm not? And she was a huge fan of the first one. So yeah, Katie, same thing. She's just so disappointed in how it is.
Well, Katie has strong opinions. Katie runs very hot and cold on things, as we know. but when it comes to Ni No Kuni 2, I'm going to posit that it's because it's pretty.
It is. It's pretty.
It's very, I mean, mostly pretty. I think the overworld is ugly. Sorry.
I'm okay with the overworld.
It clashes so badly.
It does clash.
Badly.
I will give you that.
But, it really does.
I don't think it's too bad.
I think it's terrible. I hated the skirmishes.
Oh, the skirmishes
I thought
are
the skirmishes
awful.
Were terrible.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's pretty for the most part.
Yeah.
The cell shading is very nice. So that's a big mark in its favor.
Yes, absolutely.
It's very digestible. Goes down easy. It's kind of light and fun. Mm-hmm. The battle system isn't terrible.
Yeah.
And I think the castle building mechanic is fairly well realized and fairly like fleshed out. And I know that like several of the views really called it out, and I was inclined to agree until I had to spend the last full 5 hours or so grinding fetch quests in order to get to the final level so I can unlock the final act. You said that you had an easier time pacing it out.
I did. Basically, I would go into the desert, which was full of enemies. I'd kind of beat them up, level up, and go back and collect my King's Guilder. So I found stuff to do. Although, first of all, there's a level 4 that I never reached. I looked at that, like, you know, 5,000, 5 million King Guilders.
Never
like
happening.
I said, nope,
I just,
happen.
There's no reason to go that high.
That's the thing. There's no reason to do that. And it's funny, when I was in the areas where I was building up levels, and that's like in the cold region, the polar region, and the desert region, I said, you know, it feels like something's supposed to be here, and they ran out of time. And I feel
you think
like,
so?
I really think so. I really think they ran out of time with this game, because it had been already delayed a few times, and it could be the reason why they really padded things out with the town building in the end, and why there's just a lack of really meaningful quests.
I think that's a really salient observation. It does feel like there's a lot of half-baked elements in this game.
Yeah.
And I think it explains a lot as to why they ultimately decided to gate the castle so they could pad out the time a little bit and force you into the fetch quest.
Yeah.
And you're right, like, there's that polar area and also maybe the desert area that feel extremely empty, and it feels like they're supposed to be like, oh, also go explore these. There's some stuff there, and it's kind of fun to go around with your airship, though there's not a lot there, and you get the sense that perhaps there are more kingdoms that were going to be there as well.
Yeah, I definitely got that feeling. Maybe one in the desert, one in the polar area. I did notice the polar area had this huge battleship just crashed there. And I'm like, wow, what is this about? But like a lot of
it's actually set in the Xenogears universe.
God forbid. Actually, that'd be awesome. But like a lot
Evan
of things.
Evan Pettywhisker is, in fact, the latest incarnation of Fei Fong Wong.
Oh, God. Why would you do that?
I finally figured out the answer, the connection.
You go.
Anyway, continue, Nadia.
Well, I was going to say this huge battleship was crashed. I'm like, can you do something with that? Because, I mean, it was taking up like half the map, just this thing. And it's funny, I was looking at the title screen when I finished the game, and it kind of scrolls past this big war scene. I'm trying to remember if that had anything to do with the story. Just so many elements there that just didn't gel.
No, there's a background element going on with the story. It was like, once upon a time, these kingdoms were all at war, but then they weren't at war.
Yeah.
The
end.
And so, like, that's part of the backstory. Maybe that's why they had the big crashed battleship to show, like, oh, yes, also these kingdoms were at war at one point.
Right, right. But who the hell was controlling that?
Yeah.
Some idiots.
Another aspect that I don't think is especially well fleshed out are the Higgledies.
Yeah. There are so many of them, and I just didn't mess around with them a lot, and I find myself just getting along just fine.
I did mess around with them.
Oh.
But I didn't find a lot of reason to do so.
Right.
Because they didn't do a good enough job of differentiating the skills.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. First of all, they all have weird names that you kind of have to look up, like, in the menu. Second of all, leveling them up is a pain in the butt because they each require a different kind of item.
Yes, and the items are kind of annoying to get.
Yeah, definitely.
Though, late in the game, you can basically craft them or buy them from your town castle shops and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I had them leveled up to like level 5 or something to that effect. Or I leveled them up quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
And especially the dark energy Higgledy.
Yeah, I had one something like I can't remember
the black
name.
Hole Higgledy was actually pretty good.
Okay, mine was called like something the wrong one. I'm like, hey, that's
because
a pretty
you
cool, that's a cool name.
Because you could use its ability. Once you activated its ability, half the map would be taken up, would be hit with this black hole blast that would often, if an enemy was weak to it, it would just annihilate it.
Oh,
it
damn.
Would just blow it off the map.
Oh, I could have used that.
Yeah, and then I had two cannon Higgledies.
Yeah, I had those.
Yeah, and something else, and a wind Higgledy, or a healing Higgledy. That's what I had, the green Higgledy. But I used the same Higgledies for most of the game.
Yeah, so did I. I changed out maybe a couple of times, and I was fine.
Yeah.
Can I say that I'm a little bit cheesed up by how the whole betrayal subplot went with Roland?
It was so predictable, right? I mean,
it was so predictable.
So, like, for background, there's a chapter where suddenly it's like, oh, Roland is meeting with a mysterious stranger, and it appears that he is betraying he's betraying King Evan to join up with Ding Dong Dell. And it's just like, yeah, he's obviously not betraying Evan.
No.
And it was a good moment where it looks like he kills off one of the Sky Pirates, and you're like, oh, well, I wonder what he actually did, because he obviously didn't kill this guy. But of course, he tranquilized him.
Yeah.
Of course, he was just using it to sneak into Ding Dong Dell so that he could get, like, in cahoots with the rat guy, Mazinger. And it's just like, yeah, okay, whatever. Yes, this is really obvious.
The thing that pisses me off about it is, number one, they took advantage of that Sky Pirate, Batu. They literally, part of the plan, they tell him this to his face, is you had to be stupid enough to fall for it and get mad about it. And
well, there was like a camera or something that was watching them.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, you guys, first of all, you couldn't tell King Evan, hey, this is going to be our plan while the camera's watching, so just play along with us. But to tell this poor Sky Pirate to his face that you're a stupid idiot and that's why you fell for this, ha ha ha, and he's just like, oh, gee, I guess you got me there.
Yeah.
It just kind of lends to that whole, these characters have nothing going on theory we're talking about.
Yeah, but Batu doesn't really have much of a story once he decides to join up with Evan. He just becomes a guy.
He is a guy with a daughter who's also in the party.
Yeah, who is also there.
Maybe Evan married her.
Yeah.
I think they kind of infer that, but yeah, that was a thing that happened.
I've thought a lot about this game, and I guess it stayed in my head for a while.
Yeah.
I want to observe that I gave this game a 3.5 out of 5. Which means that I don't hate it. I just don't think that it's, like, anything especially amazing. And I think that holds true more than ever. And mm-hmm. I think the thing that... So when I finished the game and the credits rolled, I went into our Slack channel and I was just, like, waving my arms and going, this game could have been amazing! This game could have been in my top 5 game of the year! Holy crap! I mean, it's pretty... And I really like the castle building mechanics and the recruiting of the stuff. And if you just did a few things differently, mm-hmm. this game would have just been like really special. And as it is, it's mediocre. I'm going to forget that I played it in a year.
Yeah, I'm probably never going to forget how angry I am about how mediocre it is, though.
What?
I'm not going to forget about how angry I am about how mediocre it is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not angry that it's mediocre. I'm just annoyed that it felt like they were really onto something special here, and they just could not follow through on the execution.
Yeah, yeah, they just kind of yanked it away from you with the last second.
And I'm further baffled by why people like it so much, or at least critics.
I'm baffled by the people who are making comparisons to Suikoden 2. Even the castle building mechanic is nothing like Suikoden 2. What the hell are you people talking about?
Yeah. I think the Suikoden is comparisons are really easy, kind of surface level observations to make, and maybe people can disagree with me, but like Suikoden is, well, frankly, first of all, it has multiple endings.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, the castle building, if I recall correctly, is really nothing like it is the way
no.
it is in Ni no Kuni 2.
Not at all. You don't build your castle so much as you. Yeah, you do recruit people into it, but mm-hmm. but those people are in your party. They're part of the story.
Yeah, and half the fun is figuring out how to recruit them, whereas
exactly.
in Ni no Kuni 2, you're either completing fetch quests or you're basically buying them. from a merchant.
You are, because, holy shit.
Because you complete these fetch quests for this one exchange, and in return, you get all these points, and then you inevitably spend all those points on new people who you then go and meet and bring into your castle.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's nothing like Suikoden, where every single character in that game, every single member of the 108 Stars of Justice, or whatever it is.
Destiny.
Stars of Destiny. Was that it?
Yeah, Stars of Destiny.
Yeah, I did it. Yeah, no, they all are fairly interesting characters in their own right, and they kind of bring their own texture to it. I don't really remember anything about the characters that I recruited. There was one character, their side quest was, he was a knight working for Ding Dong Dell. He was a rat knight.
Grim, yeah. I never beat the monster that was required to recruit him, because that thing just murdered me.
I took it out and managed to beat it. And I managed to get him into my party, and he wasn't anything special in the actual village or anything. And once they're in the castle, they don't contribute at all, like, cause they're not in your party or anything.
No.
But I did, like, he was that moment was at least distinctive to me, because it wasn't that I was getting five flowers. I was actually fighting an enemy, and he seemed to have a tiny little bit of a story where he was like, I am ready to die because I betrayed everybody and it sucks and I'm sad. And I'm like, oh, well, come in. You need not die to this monster. You may come and join us. So,
yeah, that was, I will say, there was one character I liked, Muriel. I can't remember how I recruited her. I just like the fact that she ran one of the units in my skirmish parties that was called the Sisters of No Mercy. And I'm always up for a Sisters of Mercy reference, so they get an A+ for that.
I wish that Ni No Kuni 2 hadn't had all of the extra world things, which I know that's the point of Ni No Kuni, but I think, so in trying to basically say, we had this fairy tale ending in which everybody was united in Ni No Kuni, and then extend that to the real world, it feels so pat and unsatisfying, and frankly pretty frustrating in light of how complex like issues are in real life.
Yeah, absolutely.
It reminds me of Gundam Wing. A show in which they literally accomplish their aim at the end of the show the end of all war.
Oh.
Where Relina, who's the main, like, one of the main protagonists and the love interest of Hiro.
Yes.
Basically decides that they're going to put down all arms. She believes in the philosophy of total pacifism, and everybody buys in.
Sure, why
and
not?
At the end, there's a big fight with a guy who kind of does that, in fact, like war, and is very chivalrous. And this fight goes on for like 3 episodes, and then they beat him, and that's the end. And everybody's like, hooray, total pacifism has come. The world is united. The end.
Big sigh.
And you're like, oh, okay, cool.
Oh,
and then
happy.
In Endless Waltz, they're getting ready to shoot the Gundams into the sun because they don't need them anymore. I mean,
well, that's a good idea.
Oh, it's kind of like, but I'm willing to almost accept it, because Gundam Wing. First of all, Gundam Wing isn't in the proper UC chronology, its own side story. And I'm just willing to accept its internal logic because it's kind of goofy and fun to watch. But the second that Ni No Kuni 2 goes, oh, yeah, we have this incredibly optimistic fairy tale Aesop going on about how we can all put aside our differences and work together. The second you can say, and also, this is exactly how we can solve all of our problems in the real world, too. That's kind of where I part ways with it, because the first image you see is literally a nuclear bomb going off.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally agree with that. And here, the thing is, you do get people like Batu telling Evan a few times, your idea is kind of crazy, it's never going to work. You have to be realistic about this. And they're like, no, I'm going to make the best kingdom ever. Everyone's going to be happy. And just the guy speaking reason here, like, there's actually a scene, one of those moments where you think they have something, serious to say. And that's near the very end of the game, where all the nations are gathering to fight the Horned One. And they're not getting along. Like, you know, the cat people are fighting with the fish people, who are fighting with the whoever, the humans. And then Evan just gets up there and, like, gives this, like, today we celebrate our Independence Day speech, except far, far worse. And everyone's like, hooray! And that's the end of that. I'm like, oh.
And in point of fact, we can all work together.
Yay.
We love you, Evan. Yeah, no, I had also completely forgot about that scene because, I mean, yeah, you're right. It was kind of a stirring thing to see everybody coming together to fight an existential threat. But that's often how this kind of thing goes. Yeah, no, I don't think that Ni No Kuni 2 does a really great job of selling me on its optimism. And I've actually kind of been wrestling a little bit with that because I think its optimism is inherently worthy. I think it's an inherently worthy message.
Yeah.
And I, as I wrote in my article, I'm a big Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
I love Star Trek. And the whole notion of Star Trek is that we will come through fire and pain, but in the end, we will survive and we will come together and we will be better. And like, this is just the basic conceit. We will put aside our differences. And it's kind of the same thing as Ni No Kuni 2, but I guess I'm willing to accept it more in the world of Star Trek little bit, because it's more about like, this is how we got better. Now let us tell some, like, let's do lots of Aesops on the human condition.
Yeah.
And look at stuff now. Whereas Ni No Kuni 2 is basically saying, this is the path to how to get things better. Just put aside your differences.
Yeah. Like, is that easy? It's just that easy. And
That's
the thing. Like, I feel like there's a good message. Like, there is a good optimistic message there that I think everyone could use right now. But it doesn't feel like there's any sort of sacrifice or pain or anything like that going on, except for maybe what Roland went through. But we don't know what he went through because the game won't tell us.
Yeah, literally the final scene is him fading away and going, well, I guess I'm going back to my post-apocalyptic hellscape. maybe I can rebuild.
Yeah.
And I was just like, huh. It would have been interesting if it had just left it on that note. And you can leave you to wonder if he'd ended up in Mad Max. We live, we die, we live again. But no, the final scene is him back in his limo, and instead of nukes, we see fireworks because he's heading to the, was it the United Nations Let's Unite the World conference?
Yeah, apparently everyone's gonna set aside their differences and sign a treaty, like just like
I can't tell if he went back and managed to actually get the peace negotiations right, or if they actually managed to rebuild the entire world in his lifetime.
I highly doubt they rebuilt his world, because that glimpse of the kind of nuclear hellscape they give you at the end of the game infers that everything is gone. And I was actually I thought it'd be kind of like, not exactly funny, but interesting if he got teleported back to the destroyed world. Because he said to Evan, I might be just going back to death and pain, but I'll rebuild. And it's like, okay, so you get teleported back to this nuclear hellscape, and you roll up your sleeves, then you die of radiation poisoning. But at least you tried.
Reminds me of Rick and Morty, where they accidentally create the Cronenbergian world, except for Morty's family, who are just living in this post-apocalyptic world with Cronenbergian horrors. And then I think it was like two seasons later, they end up back in the Cronenbergian world, and seemingly in the space of 2 years, the family has become like basically cave people. they don't even talk. They're just gigantic and terrifying, and also feast on the flesh of the Cronenberg people. And it was kind of messed up, and which is all to say that I kind of love the idea of Roland beaming back to his world, and then in a couple years, he's basically gone full Mad Max. What was it? Witness me! Witness!
I would actually love that to be Ni No Kuni 3, which I'm actually wondering if we're even going to get a Ni No Kuni 3, because I don't know if this one's selling.
It reviewed well.
You said it.
I don't know if it's sold well.
Yeah, no. That's what I'm wondering.
Good reviews, don't know if it's sold.
Yeah, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, Mike was looking at the charts and he's like, I don't see Ni No Kuni here at all, which is never a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, it was on Steam. It was on various Steam lists, but it popped up. It got very favorable reviews, but then it almost immediately disappeared. And that was that. Wasn't there a big game that came out kind of right on top of it? I think it was, it probably doesn't help that Fortnite just exploded right at the same time.
Yeah,
Fortnite Mobile really exploded at the same time. And also Sea of Thieves came out,
right,
and some other stuff came out right around that time. So it was kind of a busy period for Ni No Kuni 2 to come out.
Yeah, it is too bad, because it's not like I want the franchise to die. I want them to just try again and do better.
Nah, I don't care. Well, okay, let me rephrase that. I am always happy when more JRPGs are coming out, especially big budget JRPGs. And I think there is an instinct to celebrate these big budget JRPGs. And the people who reviewed them are by and large JRPG apologists,
yes,
myself included. I don't But on the other hand, I'm not inclined to give a JRPG a free pass just because it was a JRPG. If anything, I'm going to be harder on it because I played these games a lot and I know what makes a good JRPG. At least I like to think so. I have very specific opinions on this front. And so I would be happy to see it come back. But on the other hand, Level 5 has a mixed track record for the most part. Dark Cloud 2 was rightfully considered a classic of the PlayStation 2. What was the name of the game that they made on the PlayStation 3 that ended up basically being an MMORPG?
Oh,
that one wasn't super great.
Yeah, and there was the one on the DS, Fantasy Life, which was okay. I enjoyed that, but it was another kind of like a little bit empty, like, you know, Goonie 2.
Dragon Quest 8 and Dragon Quest 9 were both excellent.
Yeah, they did well on those.
I think in part because they got a lot of guidance from the Dragon Quest folks. I think that really helped. And Ni No Kuni 1, it has certainly its fervent fans. I know that Katie loves that game. She just really, really likes it. And it's also its fervent detractors. And now we have Ni No Kuni 2. Yeah. And also, their attempt at Gundam was probably the biggest disaster the franchise has had.
Wow, I didn't know they attempted Gundam.
Yeah, they did. They did a thing called Gundam Age, or Gundam Age, as it's called in Japan. And that was such a monumental disaster that it might have set the entire franchise back like a decade.
Ooh, that's bad.
Yeah, no, it was real bad. Because think about how people reacted to the Star Wars prequels over here, and then multiply that by about 10 times over in Japan to the way people reacted to that show. They're like, you are murdering my childhood. How dare you? Apparently, by a lot, like, people who watched it were like, it's all right, I guess, until the end, in which people were like, screw this game, screw this show, screw it, this is horrible.
Wow.
And the models were a total disaster, nobody wanted them, and the models are ultimately what keep a show alive in the mind of everybody, so... Right. Gundam Age, which was supposed to be the next Gundam 00 or the next Gundam Seed, had absolutely no legs. And it sent Bandai Namco, like, scrambling to go back to the well of, like, the UC stuff and to come up with new things to try and kind of to fix the mistakes that were made. But, yeah, no, Level 5.
It was real bad. They had a hit with Yo-Kai Watch for a while there, and I think that kind of faded out.
Yeah, Yo-Kai Watch. I know Bob really liked Yo-Kai Watch.
Yeah.
I did not care for it. I found it very kiddie. I mean, pretty.
Yeah, it was interesting, and like we talked about, I think, with him on the podcast, is that I understand why it would appeal to Japan, but not so much American kids, because the monster designs are just literally yokai, and I could see why that would be appealing to Japanese kids, but not so much American kids who are, like, really used to, like, really cool Pokemon and Digimon and stuff like that.
Oh, I think the difference between Yo-Kai Watch and Pokemon is that Pokemon has always been a game as a platform, It's a game that you play over a long period of time. It understood game as platform long before anything, really. That's the brilliance of it. It was so ahead of its time for what it was. And it was because it was made by RPG nerds.
Yes.
Giant nerds. They're called Game Freak because they were game freaks.
Quite literally game freaks.
Yeah, they put out a fanzine and everything. Made Pokemon... And they made it deep, and they put a lot of underlying numbers under the hood, and that attracted the attention of the hardcore base.
Yeah,
and they were the ones who kept following the series over time.
Yeah.
Whereas Yo-Kai Watch was always uber casual.
Yeah, that's true.
Uber casual. You got to have something for people to bite into long term, or else they're just going to disappear.
I keep falling for whenever Bob says, "Oh, this is better than Pokemon," and then I play it, and I'm like, "This isn't better than Pokemon." Like, it's like game after game after game, he does this to me, and I keep falling for it. I got to stop.
Bob doesn't like Pokemon.
No, he doesn't. I realize
Bob
that
doesn't.
Now.
Bob only likes Monster Hunter when it comes to the super hardcore in-depth RPGs. He is not a Pokemon fan, and frankly, I'm kind of burned out on Pokemon myself, but I'd play that 100 times out of 100 over Yo-Kai Watch, sorry.
Yeah, that's kind of it. Yo-Kai Watch
is for babies, is what I'm basically saying. I'm not actually saying that. I know that there are people who, like, dig the world and dig the creature designs, and like I said, it is pretty, but There's a reason that it ran out of gas. Yeah, that. It really did. Just not that much to it.
Yeah, I think even Japan is not that interested in it anymore. It might be getting a resurrection. And you say you're tired of Pokemon, but when Pokemon comes out on the Switch, you're going to hit the ceiling. You're going to go through the ceiling.
Oh, God, yes. Especially if they do it right.
Yeah.
Which I actually, well, I mean, we'll see how that goes. Anyway, so yeah, level 5 will be fine. They are an entertainment empire at this point, and which is kind of interesting. I think Ni No Kuni is probably done.
It's too bad.
Is it?
I think it is, because I just look back at the game at Ni No Kuni 2 and say, you could have been so much better, and it would have been so easy to... I feel like if you had just delayed it a little bit longer... Give me another year. I don't care. Just
they had already delayed it twice.
I know. That's the problem. But just, God, just give me a story worth following. It could have been done. You had these characters. You had these ideas that started good and had my interest. And then, oh, nope. Serpentor from G.I. Joe is a real villain here. That's a real problem.
it's a nice comfort food RPG.
It is. But even good comfort food RPGs give me a good story and good characters. Mm. Evan is like the most boring character in the world.
I've certainly seen worse stories in this one.
Okay, that's fair enough. I agree with that, but...
It goes down easy!
It really...
It's a super lightweight RPG. Like, it's a fairy tale, as I said in my original kind of, like, review discussion.
But I don't even feel like it's legitimately a fairy tale, because it wants to be a fairy tale, but it also wants to be serious. And it's just these conflicting stories are getting me so, like, stop it.
Yeah. Anyway, Ni No Kuni 2 does not get the Blood God seal of approval.
Sorry. We're really sorry for, like... bringing people down, but if the game's not selling well, I don't think we're the only ones.
Yeah, well, if you have additional thoughts, leave a note in our show notes on the website, or send me a message on Twitter at @_catbot or @Nadia Oxford, and let us know how you feel about Ni No Kuni 2. I wish we had talked more about Mausinger. Because that was actually kind of an interesting thread.
The his betrayal and all that?
Yeah. Just in the sense of they tried to tackle racial issues.
Oh, and they kind of flubbed that too, like they flubbed everything else.
What were they trying to say with that?
What are they trying to say with any of the game?
That racial issues can be solved if we just put aside our differences?
Yeah, years of oppression...
In fact, the cat monster, the cat king, wasn't being mean to them. He had their best interests at heart.
Yeah, and he wrote it in a diary, so that makes it okay. He wrote in the diary that he believes in Mausinger, and that fixes everything.
All right, Nadia, last week we did the top 5 legendary weapons in RPG history, and of course, this one seemed to spur a lot of interest and discussion. Lots of people were coming out with their own favorite legendary weapons. Here are a few. Brian Clark says, I was playing Earthbound on my 3DS a couple years ago on my lunch break and decided to try for the Sword of Kings. Took me 5 minutes.
Ooh.
Still kind of amazes me.
Oof. Yeah, good job. I hope you went out and bought a lottery ticket after that.
I hate you, Brian Clark.
I hate you.
You're the same person who got the lucky egg from Chansey on the first try, didn't you?
Oh, right, the lucky egg.
Nuclear Vomit says, my legendary weapon vote goes to the Axe of the Blood God. How did Kat obtain this weapon? Did she sell her soul? The axe is all-powerful, but it comes at a cost. Unfair labor practices. I feel sorry for Nadia's unpaid overtime. Keep your head up. Drachmalia says, one words, Vihander. Glad to see my buddy represented here. That, of course, is the big old sword that we were talking about from Dark Souls.
Yes.
Korhagen says, he mentioned the Fat Man, but didn't mention its legendary version, the experimental MIRV. This is a unique Fat Man that fires 8 mini nukes at once.
Ooh.
Also, another legendary weapon that immediately came to mind is the Umbra Sword from Oblivion. So, can I just mention something about the Fat Man?
Uh-huh.
I always end up getting like 10 of them in Fallout 4, and I always put them away and just never use them. Because A, they're extremely heavy, and so not really worth carrying around. And B, because their explosion is so big that often I end up killing myself.
Well, they are nuclear missiles, aren't they?
I think the only way that they're really useful is if you're you want to clear out maybe a building or something.
Right.
And you just launch a nuke and just take out the 10 super mutants who are hiding inside the door.
Because that's why you would do it. Idiots.
Why do you need 8? Because
why not?
You're not going to use it on a Deathclaw, because the Deathclaw is just going to come and F you up.
Even if you fire like a nuclear missile at them?
If you shoot a nuclear missile at it, probably it'll come running at you, and you'll be so close that you will end up dying from the explosion.
Oh, Deathclaws are terrifying. Them and Mirelurks. Mirelurks scare the shit out of me.
Well, Nadia, we got some corrections on the Masamune versus the Murasame.
Yes, I got a few on Twitter myself.
Talrain says, a few notes about the Masamune. First, it's not the evil sword. Nadia was thinking of the Murasame. The two swords are rivals, and the Masamune is the peaceful good one. Incidentally, both Murasame and Masamune were actual smiths, and I had the great pleasure of seeing katana forged by each of them a few years ago when Japan moved one of his exhibits to New York. Oh, that's actually really cool.
That is cool.
Masamune's katana was basically perfect looking, almost serene, while Murasame's did have a hint of evil to it.
Ooh, was it glowing?
As for the games, Masamune is in every Final Fantasy up through 7, and it's the most powerful sword in the game in both 1 and 2. It's demoted to best of its kind in FF3, it's Edge's best weapon in FF4, and it is the legendary katana in FF5. It appears in FF6, but was originally called the Aura and wasn't particularly amazing, as there were two better katana available. Sephiroth's Masamune was the first one that had a unique look, e.g. being super long, and the sword has appeared sporadically in the game since he wielded it.
Speaking of the Masamune, if I'm not mistaken, in Final Fantasy IV, you get it from what they called, the name of the monster, it was in the Lunar Core, originally called, like, you know, some sort of dark leviathan. But in the original translation, they called it the Ogopogo, which is a Canadian monster, a Canadian lake monster from BC.
Ogopogo.
It's called Ogopogo.
I had no idea that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There you go. There's a trivia.
Talrain also says there's one amazing legendary weapon that wasn't mentioned in the pod, Black Sword from Ultima 7. You forge it in the Forge of Virtue expansion and bind a demon within it. The sword is very powerful. You can talk to it, and it has a few special powers. Best of all, you can command it to kill Lord British, who's otherwise invincible.
Of course you can.
It also plays a pretty large role in Ultima 7 Part 2, but mostly being the Avatar of Virtue and wielding a black sword with a demon in it is just kind of inherently awesome.
That is pretty good.
Muchan says, don't know if this counts or not, but I personally love the Ultima spell in FF2. It's a very story-heavy spell, like Masamune as being the greatest spell in the world and needed to defeat the great evil of the world. And when you finally get it, it turns out it's completely bugged, so it doesn't really do any damage. Womp womp.
That's so Final Fantasy.
This is the Famicom version. So this great spell, you spent hours getting turned out to be extremely worthless.
It
wasn't really meant to be worthless. It was just bad coding. So I just found it to be really damn funny and legendary.
That is hilarious, because that's happened so much in old NES Final Fantasy games. Just like these things that are supposed to work just do not work.
Max Bebo defends the Dark Sword, saying that, well, it has been nerfed pretty hard. And also adds, the Rainbow Sword was probably my favorite. As mentioned, the critical hit swing. Yes. And Chrono leaping at the enemy instead of just walking is probably still the most satisfying critical hit in the game. Absolutely. Any game. Although Masamune would easily win if you could just have it shoot lasers into space and slice mountains open in battle and not just in cutscenes.
If only.
Hulu says, I mentioned the chainsaw from FF Legend when replying to the tweet asking for the best weapons, and that's still a great sword and a bit of a joke, but now I'm leaning toward Golden Sun's Soul Blade. When the second strongest attack based on pure attack stat, its Megiddo Unleash effect guarantees a x3 multiplier. This is a much better Unleash than the Dark Sword's added damage effect, making it the most powerful sword in the game. Unfortunately, it can only be equipped by Venus Elemental Adepts, meaning it's just Isaac, Felix, and Matthew. It's less powerful in Dark Dawn than the Lost Age due to the third game's changes, only making Megiddo the most powerful of the four Unleash effects the Soul Blade has in that game. Still a very good sword. And actually plot relevant now.
Oh.
And Satellite of Love says, it's interesting how far we've been out from guild-based progression in MMOs, that the idea of Thunder Fury as the guild's weapon is so odd and strange, referring to World of Warcraft. All right. So yeah, that was a fun one, and we'll probably do more lists like it going forward. So. Another thing that we're going to finally wrap up is next week we're going to finally wrap up Cosmic Star Heroine.
Yes, we are. Yes, we promise.
We've been promising that for ages, But even though I don't think we're going to finish it, I do think that it is important to put a bow on it, at mm-hmm. least, so that we can move on with our lives.
Yeah.
It's time. Yeah. It's time to move on, Nadia.
Got to get that stuff done. Got to get it done.
Yeah. And then we can decide on the next game for you to tackle.
Yeah, it's actually funny. I didn't really expect us to wind up effectively doing a Nino Kuni 2 report, but we did.
We sure did, didn't we?
We had things to say about Nino Kuni 2.
Yeah, we probably could have touched a little more on Mausinger,
yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah. Talking about all of the racial chaos of Ding Dong Dell between the cats and the rats.
Yeah, and how it all got solved because they found a diary that said, I believe in Mausinger, and that made everything better.
Oh my gosh. Could you imagine that?
It'd be one way to solve our problems.
Like that... Malcolm X finds a diary entry from somebody like some like notorious racist president that just basically goes, I totally believed in Malcolm X. At last, it all makes it better. It was just a miscommunication. We weren't actually thrown into the ghettos.
We weren't thrown into the ghettos. We weren't living in sewers like where monsters are.
All right, Axe of the Blood God is a U.S. Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Please subscribe us, rate us, rank us, review us. Tell us how awesome we are, because we love to hear from you. We love hearing your thoughts on the podcast. And, of course, we have the show notes on the website where we have our conversations about the most recent episode. As I already mentioned, follow us on all of the social medias. I'm at @TheCatBot. Nadia's @NadiaOxford. U.S. GamerNet is the Twitter feed to follow. And also check us on Twitch. We stream for a couple hours every week on Tuesday. As I said, next week we will be wrapping up Cosmic Star Heroine, and I'm sure we'll find something else to finish up. Maybe we'll have another evergreen question, because we're heading into the summer, and it's going to be about time to start finding stuff that can carry us through the lean summer months, as
yeah.
it were.
Well, E3, I'm sure, will give us some things to talk about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely going to be some stuff to be talking about in about a month or so. So please look forward to that. Yeah, yeah. There's some things coming around that I'm... maybe some stuff that we've been waiting a very long time for. So with that teaser, please look forward to it. In any case, I've been Kat Bailey, and for Nadia and myself, thanks for listening to us rant about Ni No Kuni 2 for 30 minutes.
It was fun.
And until next time, happy adventuring.